This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Nature films have shaped how many of us think about the natural world. Just think about it. From TV's Undersea World of Jacques Cousteau to Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom and PBS's Nature to commercial films like Hatari coming out of America and the big screen IMAX. Nature programs and films have really been a staple of the last half of the 20th century. Using cameras instead of guns, big game hunters brought exotic creatures into our movie theaters and living rooms, introducing us to animals and places most of us would never, ever get to see. And today, they continue with a variety of programs on PBS, cable channels, and IMAX theaters. But do these films change the way you feel about animals and nature? Do they inspire the environmental movement, or did it cause you to view nature as being little more than something meant for our entertainment? And how much of what we see actually takes place in nature? How much is staged for the cameras? This hour, we'll take a look at the evolving role of nature films in our relationship to nature. And we'll get the inside scoop on making nature films. How much do filmmakers recreate to get the shot just right? Can they go too far? And if you think you have what it takes to be a science or nature filmmaker, don't quit your day job yet, because the business of making science and nature films could be brutal. We'll talk about that. Give us a call. Our number, if you want to talk nature films, is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. George Mittman is a professor of the history of medicine, the history of science and technology studies at the University of Wisconsin. He's also the author of Real Nature, America's Romance with Wildlife on Film, published by Harvard University Press. He joins us from the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Mittman.
Thank you, Ira. And my first name's Greg.
Oh, what did I say?
You said George.
Oh, George, I'm sorry. See, you've now been formally introduced on Science Friday. I've screwed your name up. Ronald Tobias is the Discovery Network's professor of science and natural history filmmaking at Montana State University. He's also a producer and director for Black Dog Films, and he joins us from Bozeman. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Tobias.
You're very welcome.
Got your name right, did I?
You got it right.
Good. And Mike Day is executive producer for IMAX Films at the Science Museum of Minnesota. He is the executive producer of the latest IMAX film, Jane Goodall's Wild Chimpanzees. He joins us from St. Paul. Thank you for being with us, Mr.
It's
Day.
Good to be with you, Ira.
Greg Mittman, tell us how the invention of the camera transformed our relationship with nature.
Well, part of the invention of the camera was really first developed for the study of animal motion. Etienne Jules Marais in the late 19th century invented the chronophotographic gun to really study birds in flight. And it really sets up a tension through the history of nature films between the tension between cinema as a technology of entertainment and cinema as a technology of science. And I think that we see that tension throughout the 20th century from concerns about staging and films of the first commercial film, Teddy Roosevelt's Expedition to Africa, to in the 1990s concerns about staging and whether nature films were just for entertainment, when Marty Stauffer's show Wild America was accused of staging and tethering animals for.
Now, we have a lot to get. We'll get into those issues. Let's talk about the idea then. If you were a wild game hunter, you went out now with a camera, no, and you didn't shoot things. You shot things with a camera instead of with a rifle. If you brought back a different kind of trophy.
Correct. And in fact, there's a lot of overlap between big game hunting and using the camera for photography, animal photography. So if you think about just in terms of our vocabulary, point and shoot, that, and in fact, Roosevelt's expedition to Africa, which was the largest big game killing expedition in history, where they killed an estimated 40 animals a day, was really meant in the name of science. That is, that they were to bring these specimens back through taxidermy, recreate them in the large museums of natural history, like the American Museum of Natural History in New York. One of the things that the camera does, though, is enable people to bring back these animals and reanimate them now, not through killing, but through capturing them on film.
Mm-hmm. Ronald Tobias, tell us about the nature filmmaking program there at Montana State University. What do students learn?
Well, we start with a really simple and I think somewhat elegant premise, is that if we're going to be making films about science and natural history in the future, and these programs are becoming increasingly more common, then perhaps people who make them should have backgrounds, significant educational backgrounds in science. So the students coming into our program, while they often have film and television backgrounds, will also have at least an undergraduate degree in science. So when they come here, they learn the entire production process in order to become producers and directors of this kind of programming, either for exhibition or for broadcast.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a science background?
No, I'm one of the previous generation of people who got along really well faking it. But as you're probably aware, a lot of the science programming of the last decade was about the search for Sasquatch and Loch Ness monsters and aliens and so forth. So we concentrated mainly on pseudoscience than on real science. But there's been a really dramatic push for one-hour in-depth science programming, and that requires some knowledgeable background about the methods and the language of science, which my generation largely doesn't have.
Mm-hmm. Ronald Tobias, tell us how you come up, Ron, with a plot. If you're doing a nature film, you don't have human characters there. You have animals. Do you have to come up with some sort of compelling plot for a nature film?
We do. You know, the industry has been really enchanted with the notion of what something we call charismatic megavertebrates, which are the large, sexy animals that people love to hate or love to love. And we've been slowly exhausting every creature on the planet as we've been making films about them.
Right.
And finally, we got to a point where how many films about lions can this planet hold, where we shifted the focus of these films away from a pure science in the 1 year in the life of the history of a lion to what kind of science is being conducted about lions. And so people have started to come into the films themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mike Day, for IMAX, are the animals themselves good enough subjects?
Well, it's interesting what Ron was just saying about the storyline, because one of the things we have been doing a great deal of is at the front end of a project, and our Jane Goodall's Wild Chimpanzees is an example, is we sit down and we brought classic marketing research techniques, methodologies such as focus groups, audience research, to the front end, the formative evaluation stage of a project. And in the case of the Jane Goodall film, as we sat down with adults in discussion group sessions in multiple cities, our prompting question was to ask them to write down the name of famous living female scientists. And I guess for the listeners of Science Friday, they'd be a bit ashamed by how few names could actually be written down. But we saw Jane Goodall's name repeated with a great deal of frequency. But what we learned, that while she had positive name recognition, it was dated from old National Geographic television shows of 20 years ago. So audiences, they didn't know what had happened to Jane, what had happened to that study group of wild chimpanzees, this despite the fact that the studies went on and there's a whole new generation of young researchers who are studying the same group. So what we saw was an opportunity to fill in the last 20 years and update the story. And one of the beautiful things about it in terms of shooting in the world's largest film format for presentation in IMAX theaters is that we can give you that sense of environment. And when we went on our research trip to the eastern shore of Lake Tanganyika, Jane Goodall's research site, Gombe, you know, it was just intriguing to us, not just being there, but the route that you take to get there, and that we could just simply recreate this in the IMAX format. We could mm-hmm. fly you down the lakeshore past Gombe. We could land you at the wonderful little airstrip in Kigoma, Tanzania. We could take you up that multi-hour boat trip getting to this research site. So, you know, we've really had a privilege in working in IMAX, and that we can really give you this sense of environment.
But on the other hand, while you're trying to give us a sense of a reality world, Greg Mittman, many of the earlier, I mean, when I was growing up as a kid, you know, we all watched Flipper, and I didn't know that Flipper in the wild or the dolphins in the wild acted nothing like Flipper did on television.
Right, correct. And one of the things
I was told,
is
you know,
that
Flipper would stand up on its rear fluke, you know, stand up in the air on the walk, like walking on the water. And I was talking to dolphin experts, and they would tell us dolphins can't do anything like that. They have to be trained to do that.
Not only do they have to be trained to do that, but also one of the things, if we look at the kind of making of the dolphin in American culture, is the way in which particular cultural values shape the way in which we think about a particular species. So when the dolphin was first brought into captivity in the 1930s at Marine Studios, and it's really where the beginning of the making of the dolphin as a glamour species comes to the fore, dolphins are actually fairly sexually aggressive creatures, and very much so in captivity. And a lot of that behavior, which is actually was used for the training of dolphins, gets edited out of both nature films during the 1950s and is not available to the public view until actually the early 1990s when Natalie Angier in the New York Times did a science story on dolphin sexual behavior.
You mean that we don't see aggressive sexual behavior that normally goes on?
We don't in nature films, right? And that normally goes on, both in the wild and in captivity.
And we don't
and
hear.
This was a
yeah. Go ahead.
And, I'm sorry. Go ahead. No. And this was a real concern when dolphins were first put in captivity, for example, in the 1950s, because Oceanarium curators were worried that this wouldn't conform to the moral family values of 1950s. So even in some cases, hormones were used to dampen dolphin sexual activity in captivity.
And because so many of us grew up with Flipper as being the most wonderful kind of pet and companion, we don't understand how other cultures might want to eat these animals or do other things or shoo them away or kill them when they go out fishing.
Right. I think it also plays into how nature films shape our particular environmental politics, so that the focus on charismatic megafauna that Ron Tobias mentioned really focuses our attention on the conservation of individual animal species. And the dolphin's a clear case of that. If you look at the tensions in international whaling, for example, between Norway and Japan, where there the dolphin is not considered as this flipper-like, friendly, intelligent creature of the sea, but is seen more like a fish, it leads to tensions in international politics about whether these animals should be harvested or not.
And as you point out in your book, as children, as we saw any aggressiveness or any prey when one animal was eating another, we were taught how this fits into the greater scheme of nature. Now, these days, people just put these animals together to just kill each other for watching the fun of it.
Right, and we see a kind of evolving genres of nature films and what particular focus there is in particular periods of time, so that in the 1950s, with Disney's True Life Adventures that some of the audience might be familiar with, there was a real effort to portray nature as benign, as peaceful, as harmonious. And so scenes of predators killing prey were really downplayed. In the 1980s, with the expansion of cable television and more competition in the networks, one of the things is we see an increasing focus on sex and violence in the animal world. So shows like Shark Week on the Discovery Channel, Fangs, which was for a while a number one show among college adult males, that really focuses our attention on the spectacle of violence and sex in the animal world.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a short break and come back, take a lot of your calls, and talk lots more with Mike Day, executive producer for IMAX Films at the Science Museum in Minnesota. Greg Mittman, see, I'm getting everybody's name wrong today, is the author of Real Nature, America's Romance with Wildlife on Film, and Ronald Tobias is the Discovery Network's Professor of Science and Natural History Filmmaking at Montana State University. He's also a producer and director for Black Dog Films. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Welcome back. We're talking about science and nature films this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow with my guests Mike Day, Greg Mittman, Ronald Tobias, all filmmakers or people who help train filmmakers. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get a call in early. Let's go to Don in San Diego. Hi, Don.
Hi there.
Hi there.
Right. Now, let me say hello to Mike Day as well.
Hey, Don Steele. How are you, sir?
Just fine, thank you. I overheard the show as I was driving down the freeway. I got a phone call from our corporate sponsor, Semper Energy, who had helped to produce our film, Ocean Oasis, for distribution to IMAX theaters.
Don, this is non-commercial radio, I want to remind you.
Ah, okay. My apologies. Mike, of course, is familiar with our film. But the reason that I called in is because the question about can film have an impact on environmental policy? Last Tuesday, I'm proud to say that as a result of the showing of our film when it premiered in Mexico City, where President Fox attended, he promised after seeing the film that he would protect the islands in the Sea of Cortez, one of the topics of the film. And on last Tuesday, he placed the island of Espiritu Santos, an island roughly the size of Manhattan Island, he placed it into a biosphere reserve, thus protecting it forever. So certainly it can have an effect.
Hmm. Greg Mittman, any comment?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the film, but the question I would raise is in terms of what kind of effect and how does nature film channel environmental policy in particular directions. So, for example, for a long time, the focus on charismatic megafauna and individual species. And if you think about the Endangered Species Act, it's really focused on using individual species as a leverage point for preserving natural habitat. What happens when you don't have charismatic megafauna that aren't appealing on film? How does that affect the ability to mobilize public interest and support for natural habitats that need to be preserved but don't have animals that might be appealing in nature films?
And just in the reverse, look at the killings of sharks that are going on around the world. The shark populations some places are way down because of all the nature films people see about sharks.
And because of this characterization of sharks on things like Shark Week, where it's again focusing on predators killing prey.
Thanks for calling, Don.
You bet. Thank you.
1-800-989-8255. In this vein, spokespeople for nature, Jacques Cousteau would certainly have, I mean, I know when I was growing up as a child, I think he had a great influence with his films. We all huddled around the TV set to see where Jacques was going to take us and what part of the world he was going to talk about, and he was a tremendous advocate for the oceans.
Well, he's certainly been inspiring to, you know, a generation of people, and certainly for those of us that are now working in science and natural history, filmmaking, and it's something that I think all of us as filmmakers sort of bring to the table, bring to our projects that I see from project to project. And having now produced 9 of these films and traveled around the world, and what it is that's being brought is passion. It's passion for subject. It's passion for places. And it is a passion, and maybe we do have that same genetic code as you know, the big game hunter, the film director George Casey, who's been nominated for 2 Academy Awards in the documentary category, did just once say on location that that's who we are. We are the big game hunters, and we're trying to get our prey, and we're trying to bring it back, and we are trying to share it with, you know, with our tribe.
Mm-hmm. Mike, I think it was Greg who somebody said, you know, we've just about shot every tiger and lion on the planet so far. How do you decide what IMAX film you're going to make?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Let me give 3 examples, because the ideas, you know, come from a variety of directions. For example, we did a film on physical geography called The Greatest Places. It was a 7 Wonders of the World concept, and it actually came out of that Gallup poll that was done in 1988, where they were measuring geographic literacy in 9 countries, including the U.S. And the outcome of that report said that the United States seemed to be going in the wrong direction all by itself. Ours was the only country where the illiteracy of geography on the part of the younger audiences was less than older audiences. And as a result of this, you know, and under the President George Bush's initiative for the Goals 2000 Educate America Act, our nation moved forward on setting national educational standards, and we now have our national geography standards. And it was this document that actually became the guiding document for our Greatest Places film. In another case, and I'll go back to the Jane Goodall film, Jane Goodall herself was seeing her first IMAX film at the Science Museum, Science North in Sudbury, Ontario. It turned out she was seeing the film Mountain Gorillas, and she came out of the film, and we asked her what she thought, and she said, "Great format, wrong primate." And we started our research from that comment. On the other hand, we did a film called Search for the Great Sharks, and the idea for that actually came out of being on a bus ride. We were just coming off of location for a film we spent 7 years to do on the volcanoes of the Pacific, a film called Ring of Fire. And we were leaving location after having filmed for a week at the Sakurajima volcano on the southern island of Unzen, and in the back of the bus, someone started to talk about sharks and talked about whale sharks and talked about how they come into Western Australia coinciding with coral spawning that typically only happens on, you know, one night of the year. And in the course of a four-hour bus ride, we'd basically, you know, sketched out a storyline and a budget and a production plan. So
Did he get a finder's fee, the guy at the back of the bus?
No, but he did become the producer of the film.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about the science films. Let's go to the phones. Get a question from Claire in Rhode Island. Hi, Claire.
Hi. I just wanted to say I'm a docent at the Roger Williams Park Zoo in Providence, and one of the things that we do is we have biofact tables. We have skins, our skulls, or whatever, and talk to kids about them, and the reaction of the kids, the things that they have learned on the Nature Channel and on the other Through the Nature programs, I think it's very important. I think that they do have a sense that of stewardship towards the animals that they probably wouldn't get if they just had it in books. And the questions that they ask are very much right on. And also, the programs that are on Animal Planet, where they have the keepers in zoos, showing the keepers doing enrichment activities in zoos, has led to a demand in our zoos and in other zoos around the country to see the animals getting more enrichment. And I think that's very much a plus. I recognize that wild animals are an entirely different thing, you know, protecting the wild, but the concept of preservation of the species is also very important.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks for calling. You want any comments?
Well, yeah, I'd like to.
I think that one of the main points in all this that we're really talking about here is the power of film. Film can teach, and does a fairly good job teaching, but I think its main power is to inspire, is to get people to act and go out in the world and become active with it. Oftentimes we think of it just as an educational tool or as an entertainment tool, but if we do a good job as filmmakers, people actually will react by doing, which is, I guess, its greatest compliment, because then they become involved in the world itself. One of the traps of natural history filmmaking is that we make films which is, let's say, my vision of the world brought into your home, when, in fact, we want you to go out into the world and have your own vision, maybe as a result of watching one of our films.
What about the big commercial films, though? They could have a greater impact, can't they?
Well,
Free
Willy is a classic example.
Right.
There was a crassly commercial film that anthropomorphized an animal to a great extent, and yet people rallied to the cause of orcas everywhere. And poured millions of dollars into rehabilitation of Willie, and you know, there was action as a result of that film. We can see it happen, but we can also see it happen to its detriment, too. So it's a mixed blessing.
Mm-hmm. Greg Mittman, you write that to engage and sustain audiences and to ensure commercial success, emotional drama had to be made part of film nature. Can't have a successful film without that.
We can't, and I think it also speaks to the caller's point of that these films are really valuable in instilling passion and emotion, as has been brought up, and also serve a really valuable role in terms of education. But one of the things that in focusing on drama, there is a sense in which we think that nature is always dramatic. And so as people go into careers in biology as a result of watching these nature films, and certainly I was one of those, growing up watching Flipper, I went into a career in marine biology. One of the things that it shapes our experience in expecting that when you go out into the field, when you go out into the nature, that something is always going to be happening. And I know when I've talked to primatologists who talk about bringing graduate students into the field, who again are inspired by seeing someone like Jane Goodall on television, brings them into the field of primatology, they get out in the field and they may not see something happen for 2 or 3 weeks. And it's a great disappointment. And so what kinds of expectations are these nature films having in terms of our experience in the natural world, I think is a question that we need to focus more upon.
Yeah, Greg, that's an interesting point because, you know, we had to address those kind of issues in the production of our Jane Goodall film because here we were introducing the new generation of researchers, and you know, it is not a glamorous work that they do, and so we were trying to, you know, portray them as it is, which is to say it is a very rigorous undertaking. It can be very boring, and in the case of the film itself, there's a sequence that talks about some of the things we're learning anew with this group of chimpanzees, and one of those is the fact that we've always known who the mothers of these chimpanzees are through observation, but because the researchers at Gombe had chosen not to use any invasive techniques like blood samples, we never know who the fathers were, so all the lines of paternity after the family tree wasn't filled in. And now DNA analysis, you know, has reached the sophistication that you can do this from hair and dung samples. And so, you know, we do introduce our young researcher and show that glamorous work of chasing chimpanzees through the forest and now putting on her rubber gloves and bending over to collect her dung sample to take back to the laboratory.
And then the very interesting work of watching what happens in the laboratory. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Randy in Seattle. Hi, Randy.
Hi. Speaking of introducing additional elements of interest, I wanted to ask your panelists about fakery, even in the most reputable filmmaking. When I was in Australia several years ago, I spoke to one of the filmmakers who worked on a BBC film on the bowerbird, and he explained how he was given a script and had to fill that script, and one of the script items was a feral cat attacking a wild bird, and since he couldn't find a feral cat, he had to use a domestic cat, and since he couldn't convince it to attack a bird and couldn't find a bird for it to attack, he had to borrow a dead bird from a museum, tie it to a string and tie the string to the cat, and eventually get something that looked like a feral cat, if you didn't know what a feral cat really looked like, attacking a wild bird, if you didn't know the difference between a dead bird and a wild bird. And this is the BBC film that did air on television.
Let me make a brief comment. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday on NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about nature films. What about fraud? I mean, we mentioned Marty Stouffer a little bit, but he was vilified for the kind of stuff that he was doing at one point in his career. How much leeway can you be allowed in these films?
Well, I think a lot of that depends on how you define fraud. You know, if you look back in the literature, in 1905, you find the naturalist John Burroughs accusing other writers of the same kind of fraud that filmmakers are being accused of today. So it's an old argument that resurfaces every so often about people feeling betrayed about how people write about nature or how people produce films about nature. Now, the kind of fraud that this caller is talking about is blatant, and I hope it's, you know, it's rare. I certainly haven't seen anything that ridiculous in almost 20 years of filmmaking myself. But we do sometimes restage events or stage events because perhaps it's impossible to get it in the wild, or perhaps it's too intrusive to demand that of animals in the wild, so it's much safer biologically to try to recreate it with animals that are habituated to human beings. So there are all different shades of what is being called fakery, or what I prefer to call kind of a form of translation, how we translate nature to the general audience.
A lot of times, for example, you'll see a frog, something as simple as a frog or a lizard, and it just happens to have a fly there to eat while your camera happens to be there. Is that staged?
Probably, but not necessarily. You know, it's a kind of a general rule that if it's too good to be true, it probably wasn't true. But there's been instances of incredible stuff caught on camera just by the sheer luck of being at the proper place at the proper time. But that brings up issues about certain animals, like, let's say, the wolverine in the United States. If we tried to shoot a wolverine, a film about a wolverine totally in the wild, there would be no film about a wolverine in the wild. They're incredibly elusive. There aren't a lot of them. So the question is, at some point, do we use captive animals to make a film and educate people about an animal we would otherwise know nothing about or probably never see?
Could you put a little disclaimer on the film at the end or the beginning that say that some of these, you know, been staged?
And a lot of filmmakers are doing that now. Previously they didn't, because they didn't want to, quote, dispel the magic of filmmaking, which is kind of a rallying cry for over a generation. But now it's common to see disclaimers saying real or wild and captive animals were used during the making of this film.
In fact, though, in the 1950s, when Disney made True Life Adventures, initially those films were described as completely authentic and unrehearsed. And there was a series of public outcries about the fact that some of these were obviously staged. And a ethics developed among Disney nature photographies between what they considered staged and what they considered faked. Staged was recreating animal behaviors that were known to exist in the wild or that had been seen in the wild, whereas faked were putting animals in non-natural situations, creating behaviors that would never appear naturally.
Well, it's certainly going to be a real consideration with new technologies. Back to the example of doing the wolverine film, of course, we're at a stage of technology now where you can lead that wolverine onto a set of location, you know, maybe on a leash, and after you filmed it, you could go back and
you could be in Antarctica, that wolverine.
Digitally remove, yeah, you could remove the leash and put that wolverine in any environment, so...
Well, you couldn't get a wolverine on a leash under any circumstances, I can tell you that.
Well, you could paint the wolverine's leash on, couldn't you, in these days? I mean, consider that's a good point. We're gonna take a short break and come back and talk lots more about nature films. And we'll talk a bit about the business. We may have, you know, budding nature filmologists, filmographer, whatever, out there. So stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A brief program note on the next Talk of the Nation. Join Neil Conan for a look at how where you live shapes how you think. That's on the next Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking this hour about science and nature filmmaking with my guests, Ronald Tobias, the Discovery Network's Professor of Science and Natural History Filmmaking at Montana State University. He's also a producer and director of Black Dog Films. Greg Mittman is a professor of the history of medicine, the history of science, and science and technology studies at the University of Wisconsin. He's also author of Real Nature, America's Romance with Wildlife on Film, published by Harvard University Press. Mike Daig is executive producer for IMAX Films at the Science Museum of Minnesota. His most recent film is Jane Goodall's Wild Chimpanzees. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. A quick question about the series Nature, which was so popular on PBS for so many years. And it was so popular that when I did a TV show called Newton's Apple many years ago on PBS, before the program ever got started, when we were sitting around a room thinking of what kinds of science we wanted to put on the program, the producer said, I don't care what we put on our program, but every show has to end with a segment with an animal, because nature was so popular at that point. Yet nature was not a sexy follow the lives of humans or whatever, the kind of you're saying that's needed to be done in a commercial vein. I mean, it was the nature that was, you know, the hero, the heroine in that thing. There was no human interest story. I don't think there was an animal interest story in it very much. Any comments? Greg?
Well, one of the things I think that's happened recently in terms of things like NOVA and others is really more of a focus, as Mike was saying, I think, about the Jane Goodall film, more of the focus on science and the scientist as adventurer. And there's different genres of nature films where you get just a focus on nature without any humans in it, which really reinforces this, I think, dichotomy between humans and nature that shapes much of American environmentalism. But, for example, during, many of you might remember the show Wild Kingdom.
Sure.
And Marlon Perkins. And one-third of their shows they set aside for ecology shows. These were shows that were strictly about nature and its natural habitat without any human intervention. So you didn't have, for example, Jim Fowler or Marlon Perkins wrestling an anaconda, but was just naturally about that. And I think we see one of the things that happened with the expansion of cable television in the 1980s are different genres opening up. So we don't have just kind of one strict genre of nature film, mm-hmm. but different ones.
Mm-hmm. I have to say they had the greatest writing on that show, you know. The commercial lead-ins where Marlon would say, well, Jim is wrestling an anaconda. Do you wrestle with your health insurance? You know,
right.
Mutual Voma.
They always found a lead-in to Mutual Voma.
It was just incredible. Let's go to the phones. 1-800-989-8255. Joel in Sonoma. Hi, welcome
Hi.
To Science Friday. Hi there.
Hi. Well, you're talking about nature and showbiz and television, and that was really what my question was going to be about. I'd like to hear the panelists' take on people like Jack Hanna, who kind of take exotic animals and they bring them on Jay Leno, and this guy from Australia, the croc hunter, who takes the viewer out in the wild and wrestles the crocodile. How exploitive do we think this is, and how what do you think the ethic of the relationship between the show and the natural world is? And I'll take my answer off the phone.
All right, thanks for calling. Any comments?
I think people like that have a kind of it's a double-edged sword. Somebody like Steve Irwin, I know that if you talk to herpetologists, they cringe at the mention of him, and they accuse him of being reckless with animals, and that he even endangers some animals the way he handles them and so forth. But then if you talk to Discovery, they will tell you that he brings more awareness to herpetologies, to snake and so forth, than any person who has ever been on the air before. So there's a kind of a trade-off going there. In one sense, Steve Irwin is a clown. He represents a new generation of clown-like people romping through nature. But at the same time, they garner huge audiences, and as a result of that, there is increased education and awareness. So at some point, somebody might have to make a determination about, well, what's it worth? We don't want people going out and doing these kinds of things, certainly. But if we have an elevated consciousness about that animal, it may also prove worthwhile in the end.
Greg,
it was accented by what Claire said, who called in earlier from the Providence Zoo, and she was talking about how children had come, you know, into the zoo and to her discovery cart, and they had obviously, you know, become inspired, attentive, interested because of things that they had seen on TV and. Claire's call also accented for me one of the things that we've been trying to do, and I think we've pioneered from the Science Museum of Minnesota, is that we treat these as total educational projects. And so the film is sort of the centerpiece, but we're always working hard to create educational enhancements and educational materials, whether it be teachers' guides or websites or exhibits or having educator institutes in advance of release of a film so that people... real museum programmers and classroom teachers get engaged in the subject matter, and they get immersed into the subject matter, and then we send them back to their communities after we, you know, keep them here for 2-week periods to be in these institutes so that they can really magnify the educational intents and hopefully better represent the science than maybe just some of the surface nature of these programs.
Is there any science in these films?
Which films are you talking about?
Talking in general about nature films. I mean, we see animals, we see them interacting. Is there any science or anything?
Oh, there's a lot of good science in some of these films. You know, the nature of, let's say, zoos are changing themselves right now. They used to be just gulags for animals, so we could go on a Sunday and take a little drive and see animals we might not see otherwise. Mm-hmm. But now zoos are getting very proactive in terms of endangerment of species and breeding programs and so forth, and trying to return back into the environment what they've took.
what they've taken, excuse me. And you see the same thing in the science programs now, that they are concentrating on good science and trying to explore the interface between animals in a world not so far removed from us.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Greg.
Well, I was going to say one of the things we also need to remember is that the technology of film enabled certain sciences to develop. In fact, without film, the science of animal behavior, and particularly ethology, where there's a lot of focus on individual animals and studying individual animal interactions, would not have been possible. And one of the things that I think is really marks a sea change is that there is an incredible difference in funding taking place in fields like conservation biology because of networks like the Discovery Channel that are pumping money into scientists like Cynthia Moss and Ian Douglas Hamilton.
Yeah, you write in your book, some critics believe that in the commercial exploitation of dramatic nature to attract audiences, ratings, and financial revenues, nature films have, quote, sunk like so much daytime entertainment into cheap emotion, sex, and violence.
That was a quote of someone else, and I wouldn't say I necessarily agree with that. As I believe it was Ron pointed out, that there is good science in a lot of these films.
But when you sit down to do an IMAX, or when Discovery Channel or Discovery Network calls you up to do a film, do you think they're sitting down and saying, how are we going to educate the public today?
Oh, absolutely, and certainly the funders are as well, and that's part of the process. I mean, again, we start with front-end evaluation, and we bring in audiences because we want to know what they do know and what they don't know, and we want to know what they understand and don't understand. We want to know what their perceptions and as importantly, their misperceptions are. And one of the things we do is a great deal of audience evaluation throughout the production of the film, showing audiences rough cuts and fine cuts to make sure that, you know, we are measuring the learning that's going on. We are measuring changes in values. We are making sure that we are not creating misperceptions with these productions.
We're talking about science nature films this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I would have thought they would be more interested in how they're going to get the maximum audience to maximize the profits on any one of these projects.
Well, again, we do use classic, you know, marketing research techniques, and there's no doubt that, you know, one of the things that you are looking at is likability, but we're using these techniques, as I say, to make sure we are good communicators, make sure we are good educators.
Mm-hmm. I'm currently finishing a film now for Discovery on venomous snakes, spiders, and scorpions, the American Southwest, and we're going through the script now line by line with the executive producer at Discovery. Trying to determine the validity of each fact and how it would relate to an audience in ways audiences can comprehend. So if it was only a commercial sense that they were interested in, we wouldn't be going through that kind of exercise. So I agree with Greg and Mike both that this is fundamental to a lot of their thinking.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Charlie in Wichita. Hi, Charlie.
Hi. It's been a very interesting discussion. Thank you. I wanted to ask about, you talked about the Theodore Roosevelt films of the 19-teens and then the Dolphin films of the 30s, and sandwiched in between those were Martin and Osa Johnson.
Yes.
Who basically went to Africa, set up camp, lived there, and made movies. I've never seen them. I just wondered if they're available anywhere, if they've ever been shown publicly much since the time they were first made, and what kind of impact they had.
Yes, they are available through video outlets. And one of the things that Martin and Osa Johnson really ran into problems with is this issue about authenticity and artifice, because their films were sponsored by the American Museum of Natural History, really trying to promote their new African Hall, which was opening in the 1930s.
Oh.
But they, a lot of their films were staged and faked, and there was a lot of tension within the scientific community at the American Museum of Natural History of whether they weren't sacrificing education for commercialism in those films.
Okay, I just always wondered about, because like I said, I've never seen them, but
and they were hugely successful in the 1920s.
So they played in commercial theaters, and
yes, they did.
they're very interesting films to watch. I mean, they don't translate well for us today. But if you want to understand, like, the social condition of America of that time, you should watch their films, because mm-hmm. it's as much about being an American in Africa as it is about Africa.
It's like Coming Out of Africa is about. Is an animal film.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Go ahead.
Oh, he's gone. what are we? I got about less than a minute left. Mike Day, what is your next project on IMAX?
We're actually looking at trying to document a project that's underway right now to try and reestablish another migrating group of whooping cranes. There's only one migrating group in North America, going between the Yukon and Texas, and there's a lot of groups involved now in leading cranes, whoopers, on a migration from Wisconsin to Florida, taking them one way down there for the winter and then seeing if they'll come back on their own. And it's a fascinating five-year project.
Yeah. So. You know, and I have to say, in a few minutes or seconds we have left, one of the great advances in filmmaking had been the ability to fly along with the birds. The bird imprinting, that I don't know who invented that.
It was a group of Canadians called Operation Migration, and they're now involved in this whooping crane migration
program. And they actually imprinted the birds, so the birds would fly along their truck as they drove?
That's right. It's people in crane costumes that are raising these birds, wow. leading them on their migration.
Because people wonder how you get that shot right in the flock of birds.
You mount that camera right on that ultralight and fly with them.
Wow, it's a great story. Thank you all, gentlemen, for joining me this hour. Greg Mittman is a professor of history of medicine, history of science, and science and technology studies at the University of Wisconsin. He's also author of Real Nature, America's Romance with Wildlife on Film, published by Harvard University Press. If you're interested in how wildlife films, the history of them, and how they're made, this is just a terrific book. I highly recommend it. Ronald
Thank
Tobias,
you.
You're welcome, is the Discovery Network's professor of science and natural history filmmaking at Montana State University. He's also a producer and director for Black Dog Films. Mike Day is executive producer for IMAX Films at the Science Museum of Minnesota. His most recent film is Jane Goodall's Wild Chimpanzees. And Mike, please make some more 3D movies. I saw the Galapagos movie years ago in 3D. Blew me away.
Terrific.
Make some more of those, please.
Thank you, Ira.
Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Paul Masiello here in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarians Kim Molesky and Alphonse Vinn. If you have comments or questions, serve over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we have all the links to the programs. If you missed anything we talked about, you can go over there. We also have Science Friday Kids Connection, where you could get a free curricula for your students. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. We're going to be next week out of town in Portland. So we'll join you in Portland. Come and see us live at the OMSI Science Museum there and join our audience. I'm Ira Flato in New York.